Accession number 9752, reel 3.
Colonel Dillon, Reel 3. At this time, when the experienced corporals arrived, were you by now commanding a platoon within C Company, or had you changed company?
No, I was still company commander of C Company, but when these corporals came and were promoted to company sergeant major, it was a tremendous help because they were able to organize the other leading men, mostly leading men from the pits who had been accustomed to authority down below ground. They were promoted to sergeant and took their place in the company. And I was very successful in drilling my company because there was one man who stood on the right-hand rank, the front rank, a very tall chap with a brightly coloured nose. And so if I got the company inside out, as we used to say, in other words, back to front and the front ranks facing the back and so on, by judicious manoeuvring, I was able to manoeuvre them back again until I had my friend in the right position. Then I knew that the company was its right way around. Sounds all very confusing, this, but drill made it such, with such a big part of our training that you had to be able to put the company in line, and this would be about 60 or 70 yards long, and then we should be able to turn each of the four platoons around so that they were in four columns, and then each section inside each platoon into four little sections. So you would have your company cut up into 16 little blobs. Then if you turned them around, reversed them, they were facing back to front. And if you committed the folly of trying to reassemble them in one long line from that position, you had an inextricable mess. And unless you knew, as I did, how to put it right, you had to break the whole thing up, put your key man on the right, and reform. It was very undignified. It reminded me of Beau Brummel in the Regency days. He was commissioned into the Guards. And in those days, they didn't bother to attend any parades, or hardly any. And one day, Beau Brummel took station in front of his company, as he thought, because he saw a marker like I had, a tall man with a blue nose, standing there. He said, "There's my man." So he went and stood in front of that company. And the colonel came out and called to him and said, "Mr. Brummel, please take station in front of your own company." And Brummel replied, "Surely, sir, I know my own company." Colonel said, "No, you do not. So please remove it." And he had to get his own sergeant major to come and collect him and put him in front of his own company. And so that is the kind of situation one wanted to avoid.
How long did you stay company commander?
Oh, only about a fortnight.
So this period of flux, you learned the basics of drill quite quickly, in fact.
I learned some every night. Like hell, I didn't end all day.
Did you understand the importance of drill at the time, or...?
I only understood it because hell was raised if we didn't do it properly.
Did you accept its importance? I mean, did you think it was worthwhile, something that you should have been spending most of your time doing?
Yes, because we were brought up in the Waterloo tradition, where you stood and fought or moved in formation, one against the other. One of the things on which great stress was always laid was steadiness on parade. If an inspecting officer came and saw you, he always used to say, I much admire the steadiness on parade of your men, which meant they didn't move about in the ranks or scratch their noses.
When you became platoon commander, did you find it rather easier with the drill?
Oh, yes. Yes, much simpler, because they're very, very much less of it and less complex. And you knew each man personally. You knew where they'd be. So there was not much trouble then.
What other training did you take the men in?
We used to do quite a bit of small arms musketry in the Nestle factory in one of the downstairs caverns, storerooms. We had a miniature range. And then we did later on shooting with the full bore rifle at Halton Park nearby. Very little open country training, because there was no place suitable for it. We were in the midst of villages and so on.
Were you taught how to shoot yourself with a rifle?
Well, I didn't need any training, because I shot rabbits from a very early age with my own little rifle, and an air rifle before that. So it came very easily to me.
What about your revolver? Were you taught how to shoot the revolver?
Again, I didn't need any training, because I had toy pistols and things that I'd used from childhood. One of the amazing things about my revolver was that when I got to camp, a travelling tailor salesman came round, said, "Are there any items of equipment that you required?" And I said, "Yes. I want a revolver and I can't get one." "Oh," he said, "I can get you one of those." "What was it?" So I said, "It's a 4.55. He said, "What do you mean?" So I said, "A .455. He said, "Well, write it down for me, will you, please?" He said, "I don't quite understand about the point." And anyway, this tailor produced me a 4.55 Smith & Wesson, so I had that item of equipment. I still got it to this day.
Were you issued with a sword, or did you have any practice with a sword, or had that gone by the board by then?
As far as I remember, we had no practice with the sword at all.
Did you have one issued?
I think I had to buy it. But after a short time, we no longer carried them. They were withdrawn. It was discovered that in the trenches nobody ever used them, and they were distinguishing marks for officers as for snipers, and I think they were, the swords were put to rest very, very soon.
Did you go on route marches with the men?
Yeah, that was one of the principal things, because being a foot soldier, we had to learn to march, and march we did every day.
What was the procedure for a route march?
Very often we went as a whole battalion, with the band leading and four companies following. Anything missing was the transport. Probably do a 10-mile march, something like that, for lunch.
Did they have regular rests?
Oh, yes. Regular thing, 10 minutes every hour, you waited, fell out by the roadside. It was considered a great shame for anybody to fall out on the march.
Would the men sing as they marched?
Oh, yes. That's all part of the routine, keeping them going. You know, the usual stuff like Tipperary and Poppies in Flanders and so on, all the songs of the time. Marching in long columns is not nearly as pleasant as taking a walk in the countryside. You're conditioned by the things that are going on in front or behind. It's all right if you're in the front company and you can hear the band and you get the rhythm and the sound of the music. But inevitably, with all traffic, the front has to stop for some reason or other, level crossing or what have you, and the result is that everybody behind concertinas up, not very much probably, but a little, and then you start off again, and then there's the job of getting everybody into step. And there's constant, those sort of checks constantly happen all the way down the column.
Where would you march? At the head of your platoon or at the side of your platoon?
At the head, at the head of the platoon. Not at the side of it, there wasn't room. You march to the head of it and try and cheer the chaps along. Probably within the column, as if you were one of the privates yourself. Company commander would be riding his horse in front. The leading platoon commander would be there with three men alongside him, and the remainder of the company following. But it was...
How would you try and cheer the men along?
By getting them to sing, mostly.
Would you join in?
Oh, yes. Yeah, in fact, you had to. You had to get them going yourself. Come on now, what about so-and-so?
Would they sing the ruder songs, or was it just the Tipperary type?
Oh, no, they sing all the ruder ones, and the local ones, like gunning along the Scotswood Ruid to see the Scotswood races. All the local, and some that were so dirty that to this day I never found out what they were, because they were in deep dialect and always caused immense hilarity amongst the troops. I never could find out what the words were. Men who are not accustomed to marching or walking in countryside, they suffer very much in their feet, and they're always marching. It was a very good thing because it hardened up their feet for use when they were marching in France. And women in France, the only way to get from here to there was on foot. Practically, anyway. So we had to cope with sore feet and pricking blisters with needles and all the rest of it.
Did they ever sing disrespectful songs to you? Or to the officers?
No, not in a mutinous way. The feeling was pretty good, generally speaking. They knew that the men knew that they were all new to the job. They knew that we were all new to the job, and did their best in most cases to help out.
How did you get on with, as you marched through the country, what was the reception of any civilians you'd come across, or when you passed through a village, for instance?
Oh, it was very friendly.
Would they turn out and give a cheer, or would they just...
They would at first, until they got bored of it, you see, and then they got tired of it.
Now, you say you didn't do much open training, tactical exercises and things like that.
No.
Is this while you were just... How long were you at Berkhamsted?
Not very long. I think about a month.
So you didn't do any during that period. Was there any other training you did at Berkhamsted?
I can't remember that there was.
Did you have any tactical exercises in the tactical training in the sense of lectures as officers about the sort of things you'd be doing in the field? Any references to trench warfare or tactical theory? Was any of that raised?
The only time that form of training took place was when we moved to Chesham from Berkhamsted. And we had well, a large field there in which we had to dig entrenchments and so on, because the battalion had been turned into pioneers in.
Right, we'll come to that later.
Oh, right.
Were you trained in any of these special officer skills, such as transport officer, machine gun officer, or anything like that, billeting officer?
The machine gun officer was trained, he went to the machine gun school somewhere near Portsmouth. The transport officer was an ex-horseman of some sort to do with, probably with livery stables or something like that. No doubt it would have been a transport officer in a territorial area where they would all know each other, one of the hunting fraternity, something like that. So he didn't need much training. The signals people, I have no idea how they got any training. I know there were people signalling with flags doing semaphore and Morse. I used to see them out practicing their work, but who did it? I have the slightest idea.
Bayonet drill? Did you
bayonet drill came into it. Oh yes, rather, yes. Charging at sacks filled with straw, all very bloodthirsty.
But would you do that, or just supervise it, or would the sergeant supervise it and you just watch?
I would have a run through myself just to show them how not to do it, and they would all have a go as well. It was all very ridiculous, really, because you never did anything like that in war. It was a theory, and it was a very good one.
Did you know at the time that bayonets were fairly outmoded?
No, of course we all thought that this was the way to do it.
What about the conditions of service? You mentioned that the messing was very expensive at the start, and that you couldn't live on your pay for the mess costs. Could you... what sort of mess was organised initially at Berkhamsted?
None at all. We were in billets there, and the billets were paid for by the War Office. There was a billeting officer who went around and paid the bills. I've got what it was, something extremely small, about 2 and 8 pence a day for a...
What were your billets like?
Private houses. Billeted on a married couple who had a spare room. Nice people, terraced house in Berkhamsted, very comfortable.
Did you get on well with them?
Got very well with them, yes. Corresponded with them for years afterwards, in fact. But there's no question of a central mess or anything like that.
Would you eat all your meals at the billets, or would you?
Yes.
That was the situation for as long as you were at Berkhamsted then?
Yes, you're right.
When you moved after a month, would that be in October or November 1914?
Yeah. A month. I forget when I joined.
You said September.
September. I joined the I forget when I joined the October. It would be, I think.
And where did you go then? Is this when you went to Aylesbury?
Then we went to. I'm trying to fit in where Chesham came into this.
Chesham was right at the end, I think.
And then we moved to Aylesbury. That's what it was. And billeted there. Why we moved, I don't know.
Now, I think you stayed in Aylesbury till around about March 1915, or you told me earlier.
Yes.
What were conditions like in Aylesbury? Were you in billets again?
In billets again, yes. With the usual training.
So you had no central mess there, either?
No, we had no central
mess.
How
come mess. You had to pay mess bills then? Because you said you had...
Oh, no, yes, but... they didn't come up till we got a regular mess at all.
I see.
We didn't get a regular mess till we moved to Halton Park.
I see. Right, we'll come to... So how did things change at Aylesbury? You were in private billets. What did the training just continue as before?
Yes, just the same thing.
You'd have more space for open manoeuvres there, would you, at Aylesbury? Tactical exercises?
I've no idea. I don't think there was, really. There was a little bit of open space around there. And we did a little training, marching to various places and taking up imaginary positions and so on. But there wasn't anything like Salisbury Plain.
So for these you were there from roughly October to 1914 to March 1915.
Roughly, yes.
And then you went to Halton Park, March 1915, in Buckinghamshire.
We must refresh my memory there, because where does the Bury, where does Chesham come into it? Because when we were turned into pioneers, we went to Chesham to do our pioneer training.
Now, I think there's some confusion here as to whether you went to Chesham before or after Halton Park, but at the moment you think it most likely that the Halton Park was after Chesham. That would be right, would it?
I think that is much more likely to be right, because the camp at Halton Park was built, I'm quite sure, in order to get troops out of the towns and out of billets, because it's very difficult to train in billets. And I'm sure that's the reason for Halton Park being set up.
Now, just to make a point, because by due to a faulty tape, Reel 4 was recorded before this. Yes. The Reel 4 which follows this will in fact say that you went to Chesham after Halton Park. I'll correct that in the notes.
Right.
So if we could miss out Chesham, which appears on the next reel.
Yes.
Looks like we're thinking into the future there.
Yes.
What were conditions like at Halton Park? You've been converted to a pioneer regiment. This is where you had the first full mess, I understand.
Yes, we had a marquee. We all slept, we all had bell tents. Men, officers alike, marquee for a mess, and it was the services in the mess were provided by a London firm of caterers, Searsley, Tansley and Company, and they, thinking they were dealing with a peacetime regular army mess, produced meals which are on that scale. The sort of thing I mean is that at lunchtime there would be a whole cold salmon on the sideboard in addition to legs of pork and ham and all the other accessories to a meal. And of course this is very expensive. In fact, the messing, the food alone, cost me 7 and 6 a day. And my pay was 5 and 3.
Did this include the food bill? Did that include drink, alcohol?
No, this was barely the food alone. And there were no army rations to supplement it. I mean, there wasn't a basis of bread and meat and so on, as there was later on. There was no issue for officers. See, before the war, the job of an officer was filled by people who had plenty of money, and their pay really didn't matter. It was chicken feed. And so they lived as they lived in their private lives, fairly luxuriously. The pay was a mere token. Cavalry were better paid than we were. They got 5 and 3 a day, 5 and 6 a day, I think 3 more. So, interpreted in present days, I don't know, we multiplied what by 20? Something like that. Anyway,
was there much mess tradition? You know, did they try and run it as a formal pre-war mess with passing the port and various ceremonial traditions?
No, it was obviously too difficult. It was such a heterogeneous mass of people. If there'd been a solid corps of regular officers, it would have been a different matter. But it was rather a disciplined event, and run on reasonably strict lines.
What sort of rules did they have?
Oh, there are the usual losses, mess rules. You don't discuss women or politics or religion at meals because it stops brawling. I'm not allowed to stand drinks to each other because it leads to drunkenness and unnecessary expense. I can't think of
the moment. Was there a restriction on talking shop? Because that was often the case in pre-war messes we hear. Were you allowed to talk about military affairs?
Generally speaking, not. But under the conditions we were in at the time, I think that rule was waived because everybody was trying to learn something. They're not trying to talk for the sake of talking. They're trying to learn their job. Yeah. What's this? Some regiments have funny rules. I believe that in some of the guards' regiments, members wear their hats at breakfast if they don't want to be talked to. It is a very sensible rule.
Did you have any mess games or that you would play?
Oh, yes. The usual mess games, such as are you there, brother, when you each lay down face on the floor with a roll of newspaper in your hand, and you had to guess whether the other chap wasn't banging over the head with it. That type of...
Can you remember any other ones?
...type of thing. Oh, yes, leaning forward and putting a penny as near to the... to a pepper pot on the floor as you could do without falling over. There weren't any many rowdy games that you could play because there were no mantelpieces to climb on in a tent and not much furniture. But there was a certain amount of jollification went on.
Was there much drinking? Or were the rules successful in cutting it back?
Well, it was frowned upon. I think heavy drinkers usually took a bottle to their bed with them.
That wouldn't include you at that time?
Didn't include me. I hardly drank. I couldn't afford to, for one thing.
Now, I believe you a story that we missed out, but from earlier on. I believe you have a story of saluting someone you shouldn't.
Yes, when I first joined, in fact, on my first morning, I was walking down the street, and there I saw an enormous, resplendent-looking gentleman with whiskers and medals all over him. And I thought this must be at least a general, so I promptly saluted him. It was the first officer I'd seen, and I saluted. And I did this whenever I met him, as I did every morning on the way to the company parade. And one day, a friend of mine was walking beside me, and he said, "What did you salute that old bugger for?" I said, "Well, he must be somebody very important." "Important," he said, "he's the quartermaster," and roared with laughter. However, I kept it up because he's a kind old boy. I always did that, and I got on the right side of him, and it served me well because I have to this day a prismatic compass which he gave me, which has been of inestimable value all through my service. So my mistake brought forth good.
Are there any other examples of your inexperience that you can think of, or the battalion's inexperience, officers?
I can't at the moment. There must have been so many that I was flooded out any recollections.
Was it a good-hearted feeling about it, or did people feel that there was too much incompetence and confusion, or were people working well together to try and overcome the...
Oh, I think people were working together all right, trying to overcome it. The chief grouse that the men had was the feeding, which was terribly bad. Many of them were miners and who'd been accustomed to hearty meals and lots of steak and meat and so on. When they came down to army rations, they were to them was starvation diet. And that was the only thing that really did bring about a certain amount of ill feeling and unrest.
Did they complain officially?
They used to complain every day. It was a routine that the officer of the day, the ordinary officer, attended meals, and there was always complaint. The men would always come up and say, "I've got a bit of meat that size," and complain about it. And we could do nothing. There was the army thing laid down. Of course, I have no doubt a lot of swindling went on between the contractors and the buyers. And the cooks were not trained as they are today. Cooking was awful. And so, I mean, we must excuse the troops, the indignation at the food, which really was poor.